In the 1999 movie True Crime, based on Andrew Clavin's novel of the same name, there's a dramatic ending. Frank Beecham is scheduled to be executed, and Clint Eastwood's journalist has only 12 hours to prove his innocence. Eastwood's character eventually gets a grandmother to admit her grandson was the murderer, leading not to an 11th-hour reprieve, but a 12th-hour reprieve, as the governor makes the call to halt the execution after Beecham has already been given the first drug in the three-drug lethal injection cocktail. It's the type of ending you might expect to see in a movie with the title True Crime, but not an actual true crime, where 11th-hour reprieves are exceedingly rare. But in the case of Marcellus Williams, that might not be true. The Missouri man is scheduled to be executed next Tuesday, August 22nd at 6 o'clock p.m. But in addition to there being reasons to believe that he's innocent, there's also reason to believe that his execution might be halted, and you might be able to help. Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog. Today's special episode is Marcellus Williams. Let's start this special episode by going back to 1998. On August 11th, 1998, Felicia Gale was murdered in her home in University City. The rug in the house had been vacuumed 11 days before the murder. Gale had 43 stab wounds, which were inflicted by a kitchen knife that the killer left in her body. Gale was a former reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and her husband was a prominent physician. They lived in an exclusive gated community, and according to Marcellus Williams' attorney, Daniel Gibson, these factors combined to make this a high-profile case.
Since this was in an exclusive gated community, there's probably even more political pressure for the cops to solve the crime. So that's why, in my opinion, they get desperate and have to resort to some of the things they did here, which in this case was a jailhouse snitch.
In this case, there were actually two snitches and two rewards. After there were no viable leads months after Gale's murder, her husband made an understandable decision.
Right, he put up $10,000 of his own money, and I think that was in addition to, I know all cities, big cities, usually have a more modest reward fund for unsolved homicides, usually, you know, $1,000, $2,000 through here in Kansas City where I practice. It's called the Crime Stoppers. But usually if you have a well-to-do or affluent victim whose family have money, they up the ante to try to get to get somebody to come forward to help make an arrest.
These dual rewards drew two witnesses out of the woodwork. The first was Henry Cole, a career criminal with a dozen convictions dating back 30 years. Cole claimed that Marcellus Williams gave him a jailhouse confession. But what the jury never heard was that Cole was singing a different tune to his own family.
Even his own family members have provided affidavits that he was bragging about how he had set this up and how he was going to make all this money from the reward money.
For instance, Cole's son submitted an affidavit stating that his father bragged to him that he had a caper going on and that something big was coming. Cole's son also knew that his father had made false allegations against others for years, starting in the 1980s. The second informant was someone the jury didn't know was an informant at all. Her name was Lauren Asaro, and she dated Williams around the time of Gale's murder. Asaro also claimed that Williams confessed to her. As with Cole, Asaro has witnesses questioning her credibility, witnesses who, again, weren't heard from at trial. Edward Hobson and Colleen Bailey have both said that Asaro admitted to them that she set up Williams to get the reward so she could feed her cocaine habit. They also indicated that Asaro was a known police informant who had engaged in a pattern of lying to get herself out of trouble for years. But was she lying in this case? According to Asaro, Williams admitted to her that he broke into Gale's house to burglarize before being surprised by Gale, who was in the shower. According to Asaro, a struggle ensued.
She fought for her life, and according to the one witness for the prosecution, she supposedly scratched. She says that the victim scratched Marcellus, and she saw visible scratches on his chest. And if that was true, there would have been Marcellus's DNA under her fingernails.
There were indeed blood and skin taken from Gale's fingernail clippings. They were tested and could not be matched to Williams. And then there was the other physical evidence at the scene. bloody shoe prints that didn't match the shoes of any crime scene responders, and pubic and head hairs found on Gail's shirt and the adjacent rug, which had recently been vacuumed.
Well, the shoe print evidence did not match his. They were his. When he was arrested, they took his shoes, and they were not only were they not the shoes, but his feet were the wrong size to have made those footprints. So those were exculpatory. The hairs, the foreign hairs that they found, did not match Marcellus, and there were some that didn't match either the victim or her husband.
So what was the strongest evidence against Williams? According to Asaro, soon after the murder, she saw some of Gail's property, including her laptop, in the trunk of Williams' car, and Williams actually sold Gail's laptop to a man named Glenn Roberts a day or two after her murder.
The thing with Asaro, I think, that casts a lot of doubt on her credibility was the fact that she had access to the car that all of this property was found in, and she also had keys to it. She lived in that car because she was homeless, and she was destitute, and she was making a living as a prostitute. And I think it's a very plausible theory, since the person who allegedly bought the laptop computer that belonged to the victim from Mr. Williams said that Mr. Williams said he got that computer from Laura Asaro. And I think there's a pretty plausible scenario that the person who actually did it was another one of her Johns or customers or boyfriends or however you want to put it. And there's also evidence that Cole and Asaro spoke on the phone while Cole was still in jail, and I think it doesn't stretch the imagination to try to see that if she would back him up, they would both make a lot of money, and she could help frame Mr. Williams for the crime.
If all of this sounds a bit too much like a conspiracy theory, it's important to note the following.
And actually, there are other guys that were in jail at the same time who've given affidavits that they were approached by police and other people to see if they would try to say would you corroborate Henry Cole and say that Marcellus confessed that he did this, and they all declined to do it. So that just shows what was going on and trying to build a case.
And as Gibson likes to point out, there have been multiple DNA exonerations in which the defendant has been found in possession of the victim's property soon after her murder.
And then there's also, I pointed out, there have been at least three documented DNA exonerations where the person who was accused was found in recent possession of the victim's property after the crime was committed. There's probably the most famous one is a death row case out of Florida, a guy named Paul Hildwin, who was convicted of a murder of a woman, and then he was found 2 days later when he was arrested. He had the victim's checks in his possession, which is much stronger circumstantial evidence than what was presented in this case. But the point being that although it looks bad or can be portrayed to look very incriminating, it should be trumped when you've got DNA evidence from the crime scene, and in this case on the murder weapon that's still in the victim's body, suggesting that someone other than the guy that's convicted and on death row committed the crime.
The end of Gibson's answer relates to the landmark DNA finding that came in 2015. The knife that was found in Gail's body was not tested for DNA at the time of Williams' trial, but it was tested in 2015. Specifically, Bode Laboratories conducted YSTR DNA testing on the knife and developed a male DNA profile that was not a match to Williams' DNA. Accordingly, the defense asked for the murder conviction to be tossed, or at least for a hearing to be held. They were denied on both fronts. So what was and is the prosecutor's argument?
Prosecutor's argument says, well, we don't know. This DNA could have been from the victim's husband. He could have been, like, chopping vegetables with this knife the night before, a week before, or 10 days before. But that doesn't make any sense because they've got the DNA of the husband. The St. Louis Crime Lab has a DNA profile of him. That's just a red herring. They could find out in 5 minutes whether it matches, but we know it. I'm confident it doesn't because if you think about it too, assuming he did use that knife at some point before his wife was killed, if it would have been washed and put back in the drawer, so there wouldn't be any touch DNA of his on it anyway.
Right.
And as an intuitive matter, whose DNA is more likely going to be on the knife, the person who killed her and left the knife in the body just hours before it was found, or somebody who used it in cooking a week before? That argument's ridiculous.
But you know what's not ridiculous? The claim that the MO in this case matched the MO in a similar case. Less than a month before Gail was murdered, Deborah McLean was killed in Pagedale City, about 3 miles away from University City, in a murder that remains unsolved. McLean was 40 while Gail was 42. Both women had similar builds and long brown hair. Both women were stabbed in the right sides of their necks and had multiple stab wounds on their front and back upper trunk areas. At both crime scenes, very little was disturbed, and both women were stabbed with knives from their own kitchen drawers. Finally, and maybe most importantly, the killer left the knife in both victims. According to St. Louis County Medical Examiner Dr. Mary Case, that fact is extremely rare and led her to believe that the killings were connected. So this should be easy, right? You test the knife in the McLean murder to get a DNA profile to compare it to the DNA profile on the knife in the Gale murder, and if they match, you know that Williams didn't kill Gale, and the same person who murdered McLean also killed Gale. But as is often the case, there was red tape.
Well, we've been trying to get that information actually even before I was involved in the case, before it got to federal court. The problem is under Missouri law, any police reports or other records generated in a case that has not resulted in a conviction is a closed record under the Missouri Sunshine Law. So you cannot get access to that information without a court order. And we've been trying to do that for years, and we thought when we got the order from the Missouri Supreme Court in 2015 ordering the further DNA testing, that we would also, the special master who they appointed to oversee it, who was a Boone County, Missouri trial judge, would also have the authority to either order or give us the subpoena power to get that information as well. But when we had our first phone conference with the master, he was reading from these internal memorandums that he had gotten from the Missouri Supreme Court that we didn't know about or didn't get access to, that basically told him his job was basically just to oversee the DNA testing. It didn't give him the authority or authorization to do it, to order the production of these records regarding the McLean murder, and it also did not give him the authority or go ahead to hold a hearing, an evidentiary hearing about after the DNA testing was complete.
And that takes us to this Tuesday, August 18th. On that date, the Missouri Supreme Court denied the defense's request to declare Williams innocent, or at least to delay his execution until after the defense can get access to the information in the McLean case. They didn't give a reason. So unless something changes, Williams will be executed at 6 o'clock p.m. next Tuesday, August 22nd. But what could happen in the interim? First, the U.S. Supreme Court could grant a stay of execution. Second,
Missouri either gives a reprieve or commutes his sentence, which my co-counsel had a meeting with the governor's office yesterday. And they are getting a lot of calls and emails about this case. And I think if anyone out there wants to try to do something to help, that would be the thing to do, would be to contact the governor.
So how can you contact Missouri Governor Eric Greitens to tell him you want Williams' execution to be halted or delayed? His office phone number is 573-751-3222. That's 573-751-3222. You can also tweet him at the handle at Eric Greitens. That's ERICGREITENS. And you can sign the change.org petition asking Governor Greitens to halt the execution. I'd like to thank you for listening to this special episode of Undisclosed. Susan will be back on Monday with the next episode of her series on the Gary Mitchum Reeves case.